Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Lions Watch, your one-stop shop for all things England. I'm Marcus Speller.
And I'm Luke Moore.
With English clubs flying high in Europe, Southgate faces as many as 12 absentees from England's first warm-up game. We discuss the ramifications of that. Also, we'll take the time to have a good old look at the left-back position. And we revisit World Cup 2018. First, by speaking to Sunday Times chief football writer Jonathan Northcroft for some insights from the England camp. And, of course, having a little reminisce ourselves.
That's a lovely touch. Lampard! Brilliant!
It was in now!
That surely crossed the line! It's not been given!
Well, that was the worst performance I've ever seen from an England team, ever. We were totally hopeless for 90 minutes.
It's another wretched night for England at a major tournament.
And did you also miss a left-footed player down the left side?
Yeah, but where is that player?
How are we going to win this tournament as England?
And England win on penalties!
Here we are, Luke, once again on Lions Watch.
Here we fucking go! Yeah, how you doing?
You're getting ahead of yourself.
I'm loving it.
It's next month.
It's getting closer.
It's next ruddy month. The weather might be rubbish.
Yeah.
And you think to yourself, is it really, are we in May? But oh, we are.
It's difficult to kind of reconcile that with watching the Champions League semi-final second leg in May and it being snowing. And then all of a sudden we've got a summer tournament. A well overdue summer tournament, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely right, yeah. I mean, Manchester City and Chelsea play in the Champions League final on the 29th of May. The Manchester United play in the Europa League final on the 26th of May, which, again, despite the rain and snow, is only a matter of weeks away.
Yeah.
And, of course, England's first warm-up game is on the 2nd of June against Austria. Then they play Romania on the 6th of June. Southgate said he wants to give players 7 days rest after their last game of the season. No one can understand that. So that means Raheem Sterling, Phil Foden, John Stones, Kyle Walker, Mason Mount, Ben Chilwell and Reece James, presuming that they all go to the Euros. You would certainly say the first names of that. Reece James might be a slight question mark, but we think he will go. They'll only be able to join up with England on the 5th of June at the earliest. You've also got Dean Henderson, Marcus Rashford, Harry Maguire and Luke Shaw as well. And Mason Greenwood, if he gets we think it would be a surprise call-up, but you know, his name might not be.
He'll be delighted to be included in that list in this podcast, Marcus.
Thank
but you never know. You never know.
And they would be joining up the day of the Austria game, of course. So England's first game at the Euros is on the 13th of June against Croatia, of course. So these are things that Southgate has got to keep in mind.
Yeah, and I think it speaks to the larger question that's reared its head over and over again regarding England and summer tournaments, and an aspect of it that we haven't actually talked about so far in this series, and this is a good opportunity to do so, is the pace of the Premier League.
Yep.
The intensity, the idea that the English clubs in the Premier League don't really let up on their intensity towards the end of the season if there's nothing left to play for. It still has an excellent reputation around the world as being a great product, if you want to call a football league a product, right up to the end. And it's not, you know, it's not difficult to remember when we had the first influx of foreign talent coming into the Premier League, they were talking about how excited they were to play in a league where it's really high intensity while teams try right to the end of the season, blah, blah, blah. And this feeds into that because it's, I mean, I'm tempted to say this is bloody typical England, that we get two teams in the Champions League final and one team in the Europa League final so close to a tournament that we're already excited for because of the groundwork that's been laid.
Arsenal did the good thing.
they did the decent thing.
Yeah. Just in case Saka gets a call up.
Absolutely. So well done them for once. Yeah. But it is an issue, I think. But then you think through that. I knew we were going to be talking about this today, so I thought about it. My first instinct was that this is annoying for all the reasons I've just said. But on the other hand, is it possible that we're reading a bit too much into it? These players know the squad. Most of these players you're mentioning here at least know the setup pretty well. They would have featured for England before. Pretty much all of them, I think, have featured for England before. And I don't know how much of an issue it really is. And, you know, playing the Champions League final, which we're led to believe is the pinnacle of club football and is the highest standard you can get, kind of a great way to prepare going into a tournament. You maintain your intensity right to the very end. If I don't know, chuck it back at you. If the season finished on May 1st and they weren't meeting up again for a month, would you be happy with that?
Yeah, no, I completely hear
maybe you would, maybe you wouldn't. I'm just saying there's pros and cons.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, something else is this, is that, and I don't think this would happen because long gone are the days of the intense rivalries between, say, Manchester United and Chelsea, for example, in that final in Moscow.
And the old, it was Liverpool Man United for a while, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. And Man United Arsenal and Liverpool Chelsea as well. I don't think you have these rivalries, but you don't want to be in a position where Manchester City and Chelsea get into that final and a couple of the players, I don't know, Raheem Sterling has a right old ding-dong, you know, with Ben Chilwell or something like
that. Right.
You know, that is a
like
less...
Like a Barcelona-Real Madrid type
exactly,
thing.
Exactly, yeah. Mind you, they
basically
did okay.
Yeah.
So it's far less of a concern for me there. But you don't want injuries. But in terms of the schedule in English football, I mean, Thomas Tuchel said himself recently that how brutal the schedule is in England every game, you know.
Well, particularly this season as well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you... tell you what, though, whichever team wins that final in the Champions League, and we'll focus on that one because there's two English teams, of course. You win that final. I mean, you fly to the Euros, don't you, really?
Yeah.
So I think it is interesting. I mean, do you think it could present an opportunity for those who are currently injured or struggling with injuries and those who aren't involved in those
games?
Play
their way back in.
Perhaps. I mean, that might be a little bit fanciful because, again, I think by that stage, you know, players have got to be fit or they've got to be very close to fitness. I think if someone is even 50% fit, depending, maybe he might make an exception for, say, someone like Henderson or Rice because they're key players. But then in that position, it's quite demanding. I mean, what do you think of that?
Well, what I do think is that, I mean, if I can answer it in a slightly different way, what I do think is that by this point anyway, Southgate should know what his best team is.
And his fallback plan.
Yeah, I think so. So I think there's obviously a way of approaching it where you kind of play a slightly different team for different challenges, as we've talked about before, as the tournament progresses, if we're fortunate enough to go through to the latter stage, which obviously I hope we are. But I don't think we should be approaching this from the angle of, oh, well, he's not going to get the time to work with these players and they're going to miss the June 2nd friendly. So that means we have no idea what we're doing. By this point, he should know what he's doing. And you probably, I understand, of course, the warm-up friendlies are there for a reason. But they're also called warm-ups for a reason. You get your team in position that you should already know what it's going to be. And you've said to me before, you suspect he does know what his team is. And you play them. If you can't do that, it disrupts it slightly. But is he going to learn anything more about John Stones or Raheem Sterling, you know, between now because he's going to miss a game against Romania or whatever it is? I don't think he is. So I think it is frustrating just because, to me, I approach it from a point of view where I go, well, that's just a load more intense minutes on the clock for players who are going to be, you know, by definition, slightly more tired because of it, because they're going to be desperate to win it. So would I prefer, with my England hat on, all of those top players to be out of the Champions League 3 months ago? Yeah. Because I don't give a shit about the Champions League from a fan's point of view. I like watching it, but I don't care who wins it. So yeah, that would be ideal, but we're not going to get that. And it should be seen also from the other side, which is that these players have helped these teams get to the Champions League final. So they're good players. And the fact that they're good players is a good thing for us. And also, a lot of them, if not all of them, I can't remember this off the top of my head, but most of them, with the exception, I guess, of Carl Walker, are young. And so should be able to have a lot of energy still in the tank. And then the problem is you've got an issue with, if you, to go back to your Jordan Henderson point, earliest that Jordan Henderson's being listed as coming back is the 15th of May. That's a week on Saturday. A week today, sorry, as the show comes out. And even that looks to me a little bit ambitious. He's got injuries that have been described as being around his groin, hip and pelvis. Now, that to me seems fairly serious given the amount of time he's been out. And the last quote from Klopp, I think, was at the middle of last month where he said, I don't know when he's going to be back still. So he might have his own reasons for saying that, but if he's not on a program to get back,
is it realistic?
Yeah, it's not looking good, is it? And you don't want to be in a situation, as you say, where clearly in the first game, the first warm-up game, you've got one or two players who are way off the pace, not just a little bit out of puff, are way off the pace, and you're thinking... You can't be using group games to get match fit. But let's turn our attention to the left back position. I think everyone's quite fixed on who the two left backs will be. It'll be Luke Shaw and Ben Chilwell. They both, you would very much think, will be involved in these two games, Champions League and the Europa League final. And ultimately, I'm asking who would you like to see start? And it was interesting talking about fitness and freshness. Southgate said when England played Poland at Wembley in that 2-1 win in the recent qualifier, that the reason why he chose Chilwell over Shaw, who had played against Albania, a lovely cross for Harry Kane's goal, of course. He said that it was very close, and he felt Chilwell was just a touch fresher. And that was why he went with it. So it is very stiff. Ashley Cole said fairly recently that he thinks Luke Shaw is just pipping him at the moment. What do you think, Luke?
I think it's very hard to choose between them. And I think those comments, if I'm right, I may not be, and I'm sure you'll tell me if I'm not, those comments might have come from when Tuchel took the job at Chelsea and Chilwell wasn't in the team.
No, they were in end of March.
But the point is, the comment about Chilwell being fresher, the reason he was fresher is because he wasn't playing for a while. Do you remember, he started picking Marcus Alonso for a bit, didn't he? And then Chilwell forced his way back into the team. Now he's playing regularly. I think it's astonishingly difficult to pick between them. I was thinking about this last night. They both have got really good strengths. I don't think they've played a similar amount of games in the Premier League and a similar amount of minutes.
Their stats are fairly similar. They're really six similar. Or seven assists each. Of Chilwell maybe is a goal more or something like that. It's very, very similar. I have flipped back and forth of who I would start, I'll be honest with you.
There's something about about 100 minutes between them in terms of minutes they played this season. And they're both obviously excellent players. And I would be, to be honest, perfectly comfortable with either of them playing. I did sort of convince myself last night that Luke Shaw's a slightly better crosser of the ball overall.
But I think that's where we are. You're convincing yourself of an attribute that just nudges one ahead of the other.
But to put it this way, I don't think I'm raising an eyebrow if I see a team sheet for the first group game and either of them are playing.
And that's what we want to hear, really, isn't it? That's what you want to hear. You've got two solid options. Either one, fine. He's obviously seen something in training. That's where you trust the manager.
Yeah. If you're people listening to this. I'd be very surprised if we got any feedback from people listening to this, unless they were kind of those kind of one-eyed Man United or Chelsea fans saying, "Oh, I can't believe you've said that." Obviously, one player's better than the other. I don't see that at all. I know that Luke Shaw's created a huge amount of chances mm-hmm. in the Premier League this season. Mm. And maybe that comes down to, maybe that's important when you're looking to beat teams in the group stage.
But look at Chilwell defensively. Yeah. He's part of that Chelsea defence. I mean, that also goes down to the team style. Solskjaer's teams tend to score more goals and concede more. Chilwell has been part of a very airtight Chelsea defence under Tuchel. The one thing that someone might highlight is that Chilwell has played wing-back as well.
He played wing-back against Real Madrid.
Exactly. Yeah. Now, let's assume England are going to play a back four, because clearly if there's wing-backs there, you would probably think Chilwell was probably slightly ahead.
Shaw has played wing-back as well, though.
Yeah, as you say this, I'm not even convinced myself. Yeah. But I think Chilwell's probably a little bit more well-versed than Shaw in that position. But if we're talking about a back four, do you think that is an argument? Does that nudge him ahead at all of Shaw?
I think then you look into... I mean, because if England play a back four, you probably want. It's hard to say. I do you know what? I'm not even going to try and manufacture some kind of development on the point. I'm just going to say what I said earlier, which is that I'm happy with either of them. Yeah. And I think if you had a really strong opinion about either one mm-hmm. of them, you probably haven't seen enough of the other one.
Yeah, I mean, Shaw's staked his claim because of such a strong season this year. If it was any other season, if it was last season, you'd
Marcus,
say Chilwell.
There is an element of a narrative to that, of a story to that, because he was PNG under Mourinho.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
There was talk of him being, you know, Mourinho saying, I can't even talk to this player. I have to coach him while during the game kind of thing, which is maybe a seed of truth in it, but Mourinho was largely talking bollocks there. But then his comeback from that time to now maybe looks more impressive because of where he's come from and where he is now.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Four white shirts in the wall. It's Kieran Trippier. It's in! Kieran Trippier's first goal for England is in a World Cup semi-final inside 5 minutes.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
As you may know by now, each week we're reliving the highs and lows of England's recent past to understand what has shaped Southgate's side today. And in this episode, we go back to the highest of highs, World Cup 2018. I spoke to Jonathan Northcroft, chief football writer at the Sunday Times, about his experience in the press back at World Cup 2018 with the England team. Jonathan, I'd heard journalists talk about being with England at tournaments as a bit of a slog, a bit of a poison chalice perhaps, or whatever, in the past. Quite an unsatisfying experience due to all manner of reasons. Before embarking on your journey with England and Russia, what were you expecting?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was clear there was the intention for there to be a change, because the build-up when we were in England was very different to previous tournaments. Mm. You know, starting with this kind of Super Bowl-style press conference that became famous that they held at St. George's Park. Now, you know, what it was, I mean, and they kept emphasizing this is a Super Bowl-style press conference because they wanted to show how much they learned from visiting the other side of the pond, blah, blah, blah. So we'd had that, and I must admit, this was like a big, it was in the gym hall at St. George's, and they had every single England player.
Yeah, I remember.
You know, basically, yeah, like sitting at a desk, a little bit like a sort of, I don't know, conference, a sales conference somewhere with a little name badge and all that kind of stuff. And they said to us all, you know, fill your boots, just go in, speak to whoever you like. And I can't, that might just sound like really ordinary run-of-the-mill stuff. I can't convey how different that is, or that was, to the previous, you know, sort of 20 years of covering England, where, you know, I work for the Sunday paper, so my block of a Sunday journalist would be trying to negotiate access to maybe one player or two players before a tournament, and the dailies would be doing the same. We'd all be competing with each other with the broadcasters. And, you know, things would be very limited, very controlled, and done in a sort of spirit of suspicion. And they told us they were going to do this Super Bowl style thing, and I don't think any of us really believed it was going to happen. And then there we were, standing in this hall. Well, you know, it was a kind of flip mode, because obviously people want to speak to Harry Kane and Raheem Sterling, but you know, you had you know, other guys sitting there like Fabian Delph, and us all going, oh, maybe someone should speak to Fabian, he looks a bit lonely, you know, and actually making the effort to speak to players rather than them sort of other way around. So it had changed. I think we knew when we were going to Russia, there was a spirit, there was an attempt, there was going to be an attempt to make it different. But even with that in mind, it was a real pleasant surprise, I guess, to kind of see how different it was.
Do you think that's why they did it, was to take away this kind of press versus England, as you say there? Was to try and maybe, I mean, dare I suggest, sort of get you on board with sort of England's campaign at the World Cup, if you see what I mean?
Totally. I think it was led by Gareth Southgate, first of all, and maybe also led by that kind of learning from the Olympians, learning from British cycling, looking at marginal gains. And in the same way that they put a lot of effort into set pieces or took the players to the, you know, with the paratroopers on the moors in Devon and all that kind of stuff. I just think they looked at media relations as a marginal gain they could make. Gareth had been part of the England squad, you know, 96. I'd covered England then, first tournament. Horrendous sort of atmosphere at different times between the press and England. Mm-hmm. He'd been there in 2002 when it was Beckham mania, and again, it was just players under siege from the press. So I think it came from him, and he wanted to do things differently. And I think he saw that England, one of England's problems in tournaments was players feeling burdened and feeling too much pressure, and a clear source of pressure was the press. It was, you know, being worried about what the newspaper was going to say. And I think that's where it started from, an attempt to try and do things differently. They had a different communications department. There'd been a bit of a change there. Guys with different ideas. And yeah, you know, clearly the idea of getting us all on board, although it worked for us in terms of coverage, it also definitely worked for England.
You were charmed.
Charmed is a word. Yeah, we were charmed. We were willingly charmed. And
yeah.
we gave them back what I think they were looking for, which was a whole lot of niceness and understanding.
We saw the now famous image of Harry Maguire on the unicorn, which was very much an image that suggested the England players were enjoying themselves. And one or two have said that they learned from the Wales team of 2016 and how they went around and kind of almost sort of created this kind of lads' holiday environment. There seemed to be a particularly good mood in the England camp, especially when you compare it to other camps, you know, South Africa being a very, very obvious contrasting example. How did Southgate and the coaches foster that within the camp from what you saw?
Yeah, I mean, it seems real common sense when you sort of go back. But again, it comes back to marginal gains. So, like, you mentioned South Africa. What you've got to remember is South Africa was a reaction to Baden-Baden. So Baden-Baden had been wags and it had been too open and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it wasn't open from a press point of view, but there was a feeling it was open because the wives and the girlfriends were around. So, you know, the players didn't enjoy that because their families were on the back pages all the time. Then Rustenburg in South Africa was Capello doing the boot camp thing. And that famous quote where he's, you know, someone asked him about, English lads aren't really very good at going away for 6 weeks without anything to do. And he said, oh, they can play ping pong, can't they? So there was that, you know, his idea of entertainment was, you know, do some coaching work and then play ping pong. And then little things like in Brazil, they had to travel. They were Copacabana, but it didn't really work because they had to like spend a lot of time in traffic and travel around. And again, in hindsight, it just all seems really simple. But I think Southgate found the right base, which was really quiet, little village outside St. Petersburg. Mm-hmm. They didn't really have to do much, you know. They went training in the quiet. They had plenty of time around the hotel to sort of relax. The stuff they did with us was quite, you know, I think reasonably pleasant for them. And you know, it was like a 5-minute journey from the England hotel back to their hotel. I just think he took a lot of, stress away from it. Mm-hmm. None of it's sort of rocket science, but it kind of, it's rocket science in the context of what England had done before. But I mean, going back to the kind of communications thing again, and I mentioned the taking them camping in Devon, he had this big thing about communication, how the players needed to tell their own stories, you know, like they sat on campfires and shared stuff, and you know, and I think, to be fair, it really worked. I think that was a bunch of lads who, by the time they got to Russia, had much closer bonds and kind of maybe felt they knew each other a little bit better than maybe some of the previous camps where there were divides between the United players and the Liverpool players or Chelsea players and Liverpool players or whatever. I think there's a, you know, there were genuine bonds there.
Yeah. What did you think of Southgate himself in terms of his kind of leadership style and how he was around the camp? Because, you know, the sort of the year or however long it was before, you know, in qualifying for the World Cup in Russia, you know, we'd obviously seen Sam Allardyce come and go very quickly, and then Southgate had come in as a sort of an interim boss and then seemed to sort of reluctantly take the post. And some people thought this was quite an underwhelming appointment, but he started to win people over, and I thought he spoke and continues to speak quite eloquently to the press and whatnot. And as time goes on, suddenly he becomes the kind of almost like the darling of kind of English national football. So how did you find him around the camp and his sort of leadership style and his kind of persona, if you like?
Yeah, he's very self-deprecating, which helps. I think he took away this kind of pomposity or embattled sort of nature of previous England managers and that sort of feeling. He's very good at that. And then if you remember, like in the first week, he went running in the woods and he fell over and hurt his shoulder.
Yeah.
And that actually kind of, that was almost a gift because it sort of humanized him a little bit. And he sort of came into the press conference and made a lot of jokes about himself. And I mean, he's got a gift for it. You know, he's one of the best communicators I've with the press, certainly, that I've ever seen. You can ask him anything and he's just got a kind of authenticity about him and a way of deflecting anything. And that's just natural, I suppose, as much as anything else as well. And that was really important. But when I, you know, I've said before that at the time we felt this was incredible and open. And then in hindsight, I've kind of reflected and thought maybe it wasn't that different. And when I think back about Gareth, there was a feeling at the time that he was really open and accessible. When I actually count it up, I don't think he did any more press conferences. I don't think he was available any more than Capello had been or Sven had been. But he's very good at giving the sense, or they were very good at giving the sense of being open and available.
Yeah. And looking ahead to the Euros this summer, Euro 2020, to be played in the summer of 2021, of course. Do you expect Southgate to, you know, much of the same? Is that the template in terms of dealing with the press, in terms of how to sort of manage the camp, if you like? Do you think that is the template Russia 2018 and to kind of roll out a similar kind of thing?
I think it is, but I mean, there's obvious challenges. One of them is COVID. And I just think there's different expectations now. And I think we're kind of getting back to the point where some of the players are a bit stellar. You know, I can see coming a big debate about Mount v. Mm-hmm. Grealish v. Foden, and you know, who plays there, Rashford and Sterling, do they both play? I can see those sort of issues that weren't there in 2018, where the selection was also quite straightforward, creeping up. So I think it's going to be more difficult mm-hmm. from a press point of view for England. I think they've got a different challenge coming their way, but they probably know that. I mean, Gareth's been quite, I wouldn't say narky, because Gareth Southgate's never narky, but he's been a bit sharper edged at times in the last 9 months as he's had a little bit more criticism to deal with. You know, whether it's been over not scoring enough goals, whether it's been over not mm-hmm. picking Grealish, whether it's been over three at the back. It's just that started to creep in, and he's started to show a little bit of edge back. So I think it's more dependent now on how they do on the pitch than the stuff they do around the edges.
Sterling, Jesse Lingard. Jesse Lingard! Fires in a quite beautiful third.
Superb Jonathan Northcroft there.
Yeah, great to hear from him.
Yeah, if you'd like to know more about his experience at Russia 2018, get a copy of his book, Deadlines and Darts with Delhi, My World Cup Diary, England's Rebirth in Russia and Other Unexpected Tales. It's a great title.
Yeah, it is a great
title. It really draws you in there.
Yeah, absolutely.
World Cup 2018, Luke Moore.
Yes.
I found this rather amusing because expectations were genuinely low going into this tournament. It's the only time, and it's perhaps, unless we see England fall off a cliff in the next few years, which is possible, we know the history, it was genuinely the only time that expectations were low going into a tournament. Because I found it quite amusing that in the previous few tournaments, people were saying things like, I think expectations are low, therefore I think we'll do well. And you think you've just undermined your whole argument there.
But it's gone full circle.
It really was. But going into the tournament, it did sort of, it's not a free hit going into the World Cup, but the previous one that we've spoken about, out in the first round, the Euros were a disaster going out to Iceland. Southgate was kind of like, well, who else is going to take the job? He's thrown in there. What were your expectations ahead of the tournament?
Low, I think.
Yeah.
I think I'd have to go back and check the Ramble episodes we did, but I think that...
Never do that.
No, I know I never do. I think it was probably low. I think it would be very difficult to have anything other than low mm-hmm. expectation. But having said that, you do find yourself, because what I find is because the tournaments are so spaced out, even if you go the Euro World Cup cycle, it's 2 years, right? So mm-hmm. you can convince yourself that England, you can always convince yourself that England have good players, generally speaking.
Yeah. I mean, they play in the Premier League, which is a decent stand.
It's a long time ago that England didn't have a good... You'd probably go back to the Graham Taylor era where you think England haven't really got that many good players, mm-hmm. right? They have now. Mm. So it's easy to convince yourself when you watch these players play for their clubs every week that actually the main part of being a good football team is having good players. Mm. And you shouldn't forget that.
Yeah.
So I do think there was probably an element where you were thinking, we've got some exciting young players coming through and we should have a little bit higher expectation than perhaps I felt. But a lot of that was because of the young players involved.
Yeah.
A lot was that because we had gone from a transition of playing these really established, quote-unquote, golden generation players
yeah.
who hadn't really done it for us. And as you said before, a few years before 2018 was when that kind of ended.
Yeah.
And the rest of it was a build up to what we're seeing now. And so I think the exciting element for me came from the young players, because I was definitely of the opinion of just chuck them in.
Yeah.
It can't get any worse than this. So just chuck them in and see what happens.
Yeah.
And really, I mean, we can get over kind of analytical about it. That is kind of what he did, isn't it?
Well, I mean, yeah, again, you think of 2014, 2016, it can't get any worse than that.
It just can't.
And so Jordan Pickford, Harry Maguire and Kieran Trippier were three of the stars for England at that tournament. Oh, obviously Kane was top scorer and there was other performers as well. But those three were quite unlucky. Jordan Pickford, three caps going into that tournament.
Yeah.
Harry Maguire had five. Kieran Trippier had seven.
Yeah.
Now, so they had a few, but really that's very, very low.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, Southgate, he was building this togetherness, as Jonathan mentioned in that interview a couple of times. And Southgate said to his players before the tournament, he said, if we can do something here, it'll be bigger than anything you do with your clubs.
Yeah.
And I wonder...
It's a really good thing to say.
I think it is as well. And I think that one or two of the England players said that and said that Southgate had said that before the tournament. And I wondered if they really knew that, because again, some of them had experienced terrible disappointment and others hadn't been there. And we go straight to the first game against Tunisia, and England started really, really fast, really well. 1-0 up, it was all going well. And then they nearly messed it all up. A ridiculous penalty. It was the only chance Tunisia had. And then Kane scores a very, very late goal. And that changes everything, Luke. England had a drawn 1-1 in that game.
Yeah. We talked about it. I talked about it a couple of times already in this series of shows. It's about the teams you play against and the order you play them and how you set your stall out. If England, not only that, I mean, not only just if England had drawn 1-1, even worse than that, if they considered that equaliser in the last minute, the time that Harry Kane scored the header, then it could have been a completely different story.
Yeah.
It makes a massive difference because everything's in microcosm. The whole thing, the World Cup is ostensibly long, but actually for a tournament that these players are used to being a part of, it's very short. The Champions League goes on forever. The Premier League goes on forever. The FA Cup goes for them, will go from January, I think, through till May.
Mm.
So this is a 1 month deal. So everything is exaggerated.
Mm-hmm.
And when they were able to do this, the scenes when Kane scored that winner against Tunisia, that is a large part of why they did what they did.
You could argue it's the most important goal of Southgate's England reign, because again, scoring in the last minute to scrape a win against Tunisia in your opening game is not exactly, but it was what it meant. And I think England fans thought, hang on a minute here, because that would normally end 1-1. That would normally be a damp squib. That would normally end like that. And you saw the way the players celebrated together, the togetherness of that team.
Absolutely. And I think the fact that it's Tunisia is kind of... So for me, playing Tunisia first is good, but then we had Panama in the group as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a fairly... I mean, I know Belgium were a good team, and they beat us a couple of times, but that was a good group for us.
Yep.
If you play Belgium first and you... Do you know what I mean? I've said that time and time again.
Absolutely.
You play Belgium first, you get beaten.
Mm.
Is it easier to play Tunisia second?
No.
Based on what we saw? Attritional stuff where it could go wrong before you know it, you've got 1 point from two games?
Yeah. And then from that Tunisia win, I mean, I know it was Panama. England were 5-0 up in a World Cup game. Yeah. I never thought I'd live to see the day.
I don't know how they qualified. But it was amazing. I was happy to enjoy it at the time.
It got the good times going and we were off and England were qualified. And obviously against Belgium, they lost, but it turned out in England's favour because they got the sort of slightly more straightforward side of the group. They then faced Colombia. And I remember thinking, if England go out now to Colombia, they'll really mess this up, because actually the mood in the camp, the way it's going, England, I think, should beat Colombia, even though it was a decent Colombia side.
Hmm.
That opens up as it would Sweden in the quarterfinals. And I remember thinking, do you know what? Here's the expectation. England should get to at least a semi-final here.
Yeah.
And against Colombia, of course, we know what happens. They win the penalty shootout. And it is the biggest monkey of them all, on England's back, if you like. Yeah. It's been there since 1990.
Yeah.
And England finally win a penalty shootout at World Cup. I know they won one in Euro 96. That was quickly reset after the semi-final against Germany. So that didn't really count.
But the other thing about that game, which is actually really important to mention, I don't think it's mentioned enough, is that England team, they had a mixture of they had a few experienced players in there. I mean, Kane would have been 24 at the time. Young had been around a bit. Mm-hmm. Henderson had been around a bit. Trippier was inexperienced at international level, but was a bit older.
Yep.
And you had Walker, right? The reason that was a really important win was not just because of the penalty shootout win, that's a massive part of it, but because Colombia spent 120 minutes trying to bully England out of it. They clearly thought our best way of winning this game is to batter the shit out of England,
yep.
they'll cower, and we've got some good players. We've got Falcao, we've got Cuadrado, we've got you know, two good centre backs at the time, and Sanchez and
Mina,
got a good goalkeeper. We've got the quality to get a goal here and do something, right? And England didn't stand, they didn't back down, they stood up to it. I know they weren't able to get the job done in normal time and in extra time. And the way they conceded that equaliser was gutting, which makes it even more impressive they were able to put it to one side.
Well, like,
but
when
there were two big victories there, Marcus. One was not being bullied and one was winning a penalty shootout.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And it had been such a long time England had won a knockout game at a tournament.
Yes.
It had been such a long time. Mm. 2006, I think it went back to, which is madness. You know, because 2016 was Iceland, 14 out of the thing. 2012, they were out in the first knockout game. Same in 2010, blah, blah, blah. It goes back to 2006.
Yeah.
They hadn't won a knockout game at a tournament. Mm. That's how bad it had been as an England fan.
Yeah.
So they overcome that. And of course, the penalty shootout, the scenes of celebration, you know, missing first, Pickford becomes a hero.
Yeah.
And Eric Dier sort of finishes it off. And Southgate's celebration after the game, where he'd been so measured and so calm, and then just for a moment he let out that scream of joy. It was absolutely glorious. England are then into the quarterfinal against an inferior side. And they do a good job.
It was a business. It was such a business as usual job that I don't remember much about it. Do you know what I mean? It was like kind of
You're absolutely right.
Them off 2-0, job done, business-like.
It was quite incredible. And then, of course, in the semi-final, you have to say beaten by a more canny side.
Well, I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah, and you don't agree?
Well, look, you and the production team for this show have included that information. Yep. And
I say canny. I'm not saying, you know, England were 1-0 up and, you know, had a chance to make it 2-0. I'm not necessarily better, but they were a little bit cannier is the word I'm sort of drilling down on.
They had some good players.
Yeah.
Definitely. They had some great players, and there's no question about that. Some all-time, in shape of Modric, an all-time great, in my view.
Rakitic.
Great player. Brozovic and Rakitic at the base of the midfield was great. Perisic is a high-level
Mandzukic.
Player. Yeah, they've got really good players.
Yeah.
They also had some quite notable weaknesses in their team. Like down the right-hand side, with Lovren and Chaluka.
Was it Chaluka?
I think England could have done a better job of exploiting that. But my point, this is a big, really big long run up to basically say that I actually thought England had exhausted their emotional energy against Colombia. Mm. And it just so happened that Sweden were an average team and they had enough to get past them. And I think they were totally spent by the time they played Croatia. And maybe the fact that Croatia played in a slightly different way and were a little bit more reserved. Meant that they preserved some energy. I can't quite remember all the games Croatia played. I don't know if they had any life or death in the knockout before that.
Yeah, they'd beaten Russia in the quarterfinal.
That's right.
And they'd beaten, I think it was Denmark in the second
round. Right, okay. They just seemed fresher to me.
Yeah.
When you said, oh,
which is odd because both of those games went to extra time and all that.
True,
rest of it,
actually,
you know?
Yeah. So you said cannier. I feel like they just seemed fresher. Mm. And I felt that England looked like they were cooked.
Yeah, I know. I would agree with that.
They didn't look like they were going to do anything really in extra time.
Yeah, and I think in the second half, again, England were kind of hanging on, and England aren't, under old Svenigans, you know, they'd never really defended that resolutely, really, at tournaments, you know, certainly in recent years.
But they didn't really do it under Sven, did they?
Well, defensively, they were all right under Sven, but I mean, you're going back way.
The Brazil game.
Yeah, but that was a letdown. But England are not known for being able to kind of soak up the pressure and just see out a 1-0 win, really.
No. I think I look at the 2018 summer and I look at the way that we look at that Croatia game and talk about the other games. To me, it's bittersweet because it was more than I expected and that they should be proud of what they achieved. And it was a big turnaround from I mean, the last time England got to a semi-final of a tournament was 1996.
Yeah.
And before that, it was 1990. So look, clearly, historically, it's an achievement. But the way the cards fell, they probably should have been looking at the final.
And the thing that helped me sleep...
Or do you think Croatia were just underrated?
I think with England and Croatia, I remember going into it thinking this is 50-50. And I think that, again, the way the game panned out, I think Croatia's quality shone through that little bit more. And what you say about the tiredness, certainly emotionally, I agree with. The thing that helped me sleep quite soundly at night was whoever went through France winning that game.
Oh, big time.
I've never been so sure of it in all my life. So they were
the best team.
Because I think if Belgium had snuck through, even though I think Belgium would have been favourite, say, against England or Croatia, I still think, oh, you've got a little bit of a chance. To me, France, they just look bulletproof.
Yeah.
In a sort of slightly boring way, other than the game against Argentina. But anyway, but it was interesting, though. Southgate, you could talk about 96 and 1990. Southgate didn't want an open top bus parade for reaching a semi-final, so they returned to England quite quietly.
Yeah, well, rightly so.
Absolutely. In 1990, it was a huge fanfare, and I get that. I'm not sort of having a go at that, you know. And he also said to his players, have a look around you, soak this in, because it will never be like this again. Hmm. It will never be. He never said this good, but he said this group of players in this atmosphere, it won't be like this again. Mm. He was very, very aware of seizing
the moment.
Do you reckon
he was saying that as he said it? He was really intensely looking at Ashley Young.
Yeah.
You'll be in another squad.
Yeah.
You'll be in another squad.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
You'll be in another squad.
You're lucky to be in this one.
Yeah. But I didn't want you here.
Yeah.
You're here now.
But the takeaways of that tournament for England to me was that they showed character and togetherness at the tournament.
Yeah.
And sometimes we'd seen England be too individualistic on the pitch and that kind of thing. Also, it was the start of Southgate's journey as an England manager, as opposed to the end, which we saw with Venables in 96 and Robson in 1990. That seemed to be the great crescendo of it. Whereas now Southgate was like, right, we've got that. Now let's move on.
Well, that's a really good point, because for Robson and Venables, it was the summit.
Yep.
And for Southgate, all being well, based on the promise they've shown up to this point, you'd want that to be the base camp, really.
Yeah, exactly.
This is user's experience. A lot of these players that are there would have got a lot of experience from that. It was a coming of age for Harry Kane, as I know you want to talk about.
Yeah,
and then can they kick on from that? And the proof of that, put in Marcus, will be in the eating this summer.
Yeah.
And we'll see, because they've got a lot of good players again now.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of whom haven't featured in the tournament yet.
No, you're absolutely right. And also as well, the players just seem to enjoy and relish playing for the national team again. I know players have always wanted to play for England, but this just seemed a little bit different. And England also now had a proper goal scorer in Harry Kane.
Well, that's important to stress, because you know, we shouldn't be talking about an England. We shouldn't be talking on an England podcast series and not talk about the fact that we have a golden boot winner as well,
yeah,
right?
That's right.
Because I know it was disappointing how it finished, and they did look a little bit bereft at the end against Croatia. But Kane was the standout striker in the tournament, and is he a better player now? I think he's a more rounded player now. I think there's question marks over the injuries he's had and whether he's got too many miles on the clock for his age, which we've certainly seen in the past with someone like Rooney, but I think that's premature for Kane. I think he's a better, more rounded, complete player now. And for better rather than worse, he's managed to maintain this goal-scoring rate for England that's actually quite easy. Well, not easy, but it's quite common for players at the start of their career. I think he had 13 goals and 24 caps going into this tournament. Mm-hmm. He's now maintained that level of goal-scoring for England, which is really encouraging.
Yeah, yeah.
He's not fazed by the big occasion. If he steps up to take a penalty, he's going to fucking score it. And by God, did England get some penalties in that World Cup?
Yeah, yeah.
So if that continues, he's essentially a goal. He's a very reliable penalty taker, which is a big part of VAR era football at tournaments. So there's a reason to be positive, and a lot of those reasons are rooted in this tournament.
Mm, absolutely right. Well, that's the end of this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening to Lions Watch. We'll be back next week with some more news and discussion. And we're also looking back at the road to the Nations League and that glorious night in Seville.
I'm going to have to research this one.
I'm not. I'll play it on a loop in my head.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening, everybody. See you next week.
This was a Stakhanov production and part of the Acast Creative Network.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia, movement that inspires. Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.